I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Philippa O'Brien. Welcome, Philippa.
Thank you very much.
Philippa, I'm holding here, and people listening to this podcast will see the front cover of this book, No Stone Without a Name. It's, on one view, a coffee table book, but on every other view, it's just a beautiful book with some fascinating art, but with a purpose, with an intention that goes way beyond it. Just look at the front cover. It appears Aboriginal people, looks like a British soldier, looking across some amazing vista. Just tell us, what is this? Who did it? When?
Well, I particularly hate the description coffee table book.
Yes.
It implies something vacuous in some sort of superficial social situation where you might flip some pages.
That's right. And that's why this is so much more and people do not want to be filled
that's
by
right.
the cover on the book.
So this is a book that doesn't really fit the model of the sorts of books that we're used to. So it is an art book. Every page has got a picture and all the text is about those pictures.
The text is phenomenal. I just started reading it and really couldn't stop. So who did do this cover piece?
So the cover is done by one of the soldiers here,
Dale.
Robert Dale. We all learned about him at school as known as Ensign Dale, but he actually was just one of the soldiers. And he was most of the soldiers had secondary skills, and his was that he was a military surveyor.
So he was out here in the earliest
times.
He
came with the first lot. In fact, the first work, we've got two works of his, and they're both in this book. The first one was done very, very early on, probably in 1829, and it's a picture of Fremantle taken from behind, a little bit inland from the roundhouse, looking back to where it is now, and it's actually a picture of the first raising of the flag and so on. And of course, it was actually done afterwards, but he was here when it was done. So Fremantle, the Captain Fremantle, comes a couple of weeks before the Parmelia comes.
Yes.
And their job is to set it up. And they land on where the roundhouse house is now and make a little fort, which is what Dale drew in that picture. So even though he did it after the event, and it's a really interesting picture, that one too, because first of all, you can see that it's covered in bush, which it very soon wasn't once the settlers all landed there because they cut it down. It turned into the most horrible sandy waste, which they then all complained about. But it also shows the tracks, the biddy, the Aboriginal tracks that go everywhere. And of course, that was a highway around the river there. And you can see it like a well-developed road. And there were those biddies everywhere when the settlers arrived. Very handy.
Well, Kim Scott, the noted writer and academic, has contributed a lovely foreword. And of course, the place wasn't terra nullius, as they use the Latin expression to suggest there weren't any prior occupants of the place. Mm. You've got all those biddies running everywhere. Aboriginal people were here. Mm. And there are some of them in Ensign Dale's front cover here. Where was this done?
So this is the big panorama of Albany that Dale did. And he went to Albany with Stirling, and they went down there to sort out some business because, of course, Albany, in a sense, was a more successful settlement than Perth, in that there was not the trouble between the races really didn't happen in Albany so much, mainly because it was a military settlement, and so it was a disciplined settlement. And there was no competition for land. They didn't take any land. They took one little bit of land to build their barracks. And did a bit of farming, but apart from that, they didn't take any land. And also, there was discipline, and so there was no...
The soldiers behaved themselves.
The soldiers behaved themselves. There was no toleration of anything that upset people.
Philippa, that's a very significant and important point to make, isn't it? The differences between that early settlement from about 1826 at Albany...
Yes.
And what was then happening in Perth, the real estate development where Stirling was hoping to be a successful property developer. And then the way, as settlers moved out, taking over the land, conflict arose. Mm. This is such an interesting piece of art. Is this just as Dale did it?
Well, this is the panorama, the Albany panorama, is a very important artwork, but of course it didn't look like this in the beginning. So Dale was a military surveyor, so he would have done what a military surveyor would do. It would be quite an austere but very accurate picture of the hills and the bays and the coastline and what he could see. And of course, surveying in those days was not as accurate an art as it later became. And so paintings were quite often used to sort out the finer points. They were sort of legal documents. In fact, in England, that was the way that a lot of painters earned a living. So Dale, like his one of the Roundhouse, he took his prints back to England, his drawings back to England. And then, as happened to almost everything in this whole book, that original artwork done by someone who had seen the place was then given to the printers in London. So in London, in Paris and all over Europe, these huge print workshops existed. Very professional, lots of artists, and it was just a huge industry. So if you think of all of those books of views, of foreign views and so on, I'm sure we can all imagine, but lots of artists of different sorts were doing it. Views of exotic places and so on. So it was a big industry, but of course there was also a political side to it. Political cartoons are on the go at the moment, and they're all done by these print workshops. So Dale takes his artwork, his quite austere drawing of the landforms from the top of the mountain in Albany, in a big 180 degree semicircle.
Oh, that's Princess Royal Harbour.
All of that, yes, an oyster harbour over there.
So if you go to just after page 279 in the book, there's this fantastic fold out, and it shows that whole panorama.
It does indeed, and it's about a third scale, 1 to 3. The panorama is actually about 3 metres wide.
So he delivers his drawings.
Yes.
It's a well understood industry, as you've described.
Yeah.
It's the way things were done. The people who reproduce these things turn it into what we're looking at, and it's got the water, it's got the harbour, which is probably all technically very accurate. It's got these other trees that looks like palms and grass trees and. But where were they? Were they have all been in the drawing? Or?
Well, what? First of all, just think of what the process is. So they've got their original drawing. So they lay out the basic sort of groundwork of the drawing, and so they're printers. So they're going to make a black and white printing block. So that's the first thing that happens. So probably an artist worked on it, turning into something that would be acceptable. That point would have been when they said, well, here, let's put the horizon over there, and we've got to put these people in. We want to make a sort of narrative across the front, so we put this curvy line across the front, and we put the narrative of all the people following that, so it looks very attractive, and it's sort of easy to read. See, it just comes along, and the whole story of the interaction between the races along this line, it's like a path, but it's also like a narrative line. And then they wanted to fill in the foreground with some plants, which would be the natural thing to do. Well, Dale had given them a couple of drawings. He would have probably given them a little folio of drawings of perhaps some of these people, interaction between some Aboriginal people, some soldiers. Perhaps he gave them some particular drawings of plants. We don't know what else. He, for instance, there's a little incident here where there's a rock with a stone underneath it propped up. And he drew something there that he must have seen, because what it was a goanna trap, so that the Aboriginal hunters would drive the goanna into a trap. But that's sitting right beside his drawing of a man chasing a goanna up a tree, which would never have happened because that means he wouldn't have caught his goanna. So he's recorded two things that tell us that he would really looked at something.
One thing I've picked up over the years is this challenge for artists, generally speaking, who have come to a new land like Australia from somewhere like Britain, and have to then draw and paint the new Australian scenery, and they can make trees look like English trees. Is this all Australia?
Well, that is the basic condition of all of our early art, and it has a big part to play in some real ideas that develop about Australian culture. Everything we saw came back through this process of the English print workshops, and it looked different. So one of the rules of art, especially watercolour painting, is truth to nature. Try and catch this, what it really looked like. Well, this is a special process that annihilates that. And in fact, we always saw things that looked as if they were improved or civilized, as if our nature wasn't good enough. And here's a better version of it. And it led to, first of all, that the idea that that we were uncultured, that we had no history, that we didn't fit into this cultural pattern properly. But it also, in fact, I think, led to a lot of environmental ideas, so that we didn't actually look at the land properly, we didn't see it properly. We saw this thing that had to be improved and turned into something that had to look like Europe.
It's crazy, isn't it? So if you were interested in coming out to the Swan River Colony circa 1835 or something, and you're looking at these wonderful prints, you think, oh, this looks a little bit like Hampshire or perhaps Oxfordshire or somewhere, right. And let's head off there and set up a farm.
And so one of the things that Stirling was accused of was painting too rosy a picture of things. His version of the colony was words, and he said this is wonderful, rich trees and grass and grassy plains and so on. But we've also got Garling's paintings, which shows us very beautiful things too, like the riverbanks, the well-kept riverbanks and all of that. But people then were annoyed that when they came to plant stuff here, European plants didn't grow very well. And when they came to farm, European farming methods were quite difficult to implement. And so they came to distrust, they came to believe, in a sense, this lack of trust in the version that we've been told about it, that somehow it was not true and we are not somehow the fitting into this civilised picture, this improved life that we could have, that it's somehow deficient.
Yes, and then you go back to William Dampier's comments from looking at a sandy limestone soil halfway up the West Australian coast, and you think the whole thing's godforsaken.
Yeah.
The contents to this book then start to tell the animated reader like me, when I just flick through some of the paintings, which each of them could be an essay in both art history, social, economic and political science in this country. But you start off after the wonderful foreword and a preface. You're talking about the ancient land, the ancestral cosmos. You're mapping the Indian Ocean, you're touching the land, the puzzle of the Pacific. You look at the various scientific expeditions to Western Australia, which are all phenomenal on their own. I've always been taken by Nicolai Bodin's visit, but they're all equally exciting. Including Philip Parker King, who people often forget about, who went all the way around Australia years later, and great journal notes. And
that's right.
And if anyone ever sort of completely destroyed the idea that land wasn't inhabited, he kept seeing the smoke from the fires of the Aboriginal people
everywhere. Yes.
The imperial ambition, of course, which explains why the Swan River Colony was set up. You talk about a sense of entitlement. The colony materialises. You're on the banks of the Swan. Guns over spears, colonial dynasties settling in, the eye of the outsider, earning your land, and it goes on. And the reader starts to think they understand why you might have written this book. But tell us, why did you write this book?
For a lot of reasons. I guess one of the important things about this book is that I started a long time ago being interested in it and started to become, I've long been familiar with the material. And there's only one previous version of it.
Well, you're an artist.
That's true. I also taught art history a lot and cultural studies and all that sort of stuff. First of all, it fits into the period that I taught, which is Romanticism, which means 18th, 19th centuries. It was a period of art that I was really familiar with and very interested in. And I mean, a long time ago, I wrote a paper about Georgiana Molloy, which is a lot of people devote a lot of time to. But my picture of her was really quite different. I wanted to place her in the context of the Europe that she came from and then drop her into WA. And so we have to, for instance, for Georgiana Molloy, she was very religious, and that took her into all of the places where the radical progressive thinkers were running the anti-slavery campaign, and a very, I guess, the good side of the Christian religion in Europe, working for those liberal ideas of the end of slavery and so on.
And she finishes up in Augusta.
She sure does, with a husband who's the boss of the army, who's got a little problem with the they're not called slaves, but some of them they would have liked to have been, to enroll them as slaves if they could have, but they were also a different sort of problem that really was a moral issue for her. And she's one of the few people with Wollaston who does talk about that, the morality of that. Wollaston, the Anglican priest who comes and lives in the southwest and walks around everywhere, knows everyone, is a great social commentator and historian, is often voices those moral questions.
So this book tells a story really of contact, first contact.
Well, can I just say one thing?
Yes.
First, Michael, that one of the things that was interesting to me is something that makes people laugh sometimes. I had an original title that would have been very offensive to some people, and it was Cradle of the Nation, because of course everything happens here so much earlier than it did on the East Coast. And there's a map in here done in the year 1771, which is the year that Cook hits the East Coast. And that is the French putting their claim on the continent on the West Coast, same year. But of course, Dampier's nearly 100 years before, and then there's other contact. We've got also all the contact known before is all to do with the North and the West Coast. So we, our whole history of the Dutch contact and so on is all happening here. And the map, there's also a map done in 1771, which has got a beautiful wriggly line down from about the right down, sort of not quite hitting the East Coast. It's a wriggly line, and a very rational French map maker said, "Don't know what happens after here, so I put a wriggly line down." And the western two thirds are there, but the East Coast is not even on the map until 1771.
Well, we nearly seceded from that other part of the country in 1933.
That's right.
But where did the title then come from, No Stone Without a Name?
Well, one of the people that I discovered in reading up all the stuff and just learning about it, so George Grey, who comes to WA as a young man, he's just got his colours as a British officer. He's sent to Ireland. He sees the poverty. He's quite upset about what's happening in Ireland, which is the British behaving very badly, and he sees the plight of the Irish people, and he thinks to himself, migration is the one of the solutions. And so then he comes to Australia, he comes to the West Coast, and he does a bit of exploring. I think he came on one of the Beagle explorations, because after Charles Darwin and his time on the Beagle continued to be an exploring ship around, especially around Northern Australia. Grey is dropped off in the north, and he explores the north a bit, and then another expedition, his little ship damaged, and he had to walk from about Geraldton back to Perth.
It's a terrible expedition.
Well, it's actually really interesting to think of the details of it. One of the young fellows with him, he had a party of about a dozen people. One of them was a young 19-year-old nephew of Florence Nightingale. And the thing is, one of the things I wanted to do in the book is tie it back to the big picture, so that you're always relating it to things. So I really wanted to put that connection to Florence Nightingale in, because it makes you see it connecting all the time to the other society that we know lots about.
This huge British empire, this imperial project, these people, particularly in the 1830s and later, they're all products of centuries of British domination.
But we are very familiar with some of this. Everyone knows Florence Nightingale. Everyone's got a picture of how she fits into something. To some degree, you know something about that world that Florence Nightingale summons up. So her 19-year-old nephew died on the beach halfway to Perth.
And Grey goes off to New Zealand. He becomes prominent in politics. He comes back to South Australia as governor. He has his career.
And he's the great Lord Grey, boss of New Zealand and all of that.
Oh.
Yes, but anyway, as a young man, he writes this diary and then publishes a book about this walk of the whole West Australian, the two expeditions. And it's actually a very, very interesting book because he's not, one of the things about these people coming in like Grey, they were not settlers, they were not, they hadn't been...
Well, they were functionaries.
They were free to think. First of all, their welfare wasn't tied up in the colony. They
yes.
didn't own land. They didn't have to earn their living. They weren't going to starve if they went broke. But secondly, they also were not hadn't been proselytised. They hadn't had their minds bent. When people came here on the ships, for instance, later on when convicts came, they had someone on the boat, usually a parson, whose job it was to set the minds right of who was good, who was bad. For instance, they had a lot of stories that they told the convicts about how evil the Aborigines were and violent and dangerous and all of those things, because people had to get their head in the right position so they understood who was who in the world they were coming to. Well, of course, people like Grey had not done that. He actually came here as a young man who had his ideas, and he thought that this might be a good place for the Irish to come. Another thing about Grey was that he was, like quite a few of them, this is the beginning in Europe of the beginning of the sciences of anthropology and ethnology, and, you know, Troy is being discovered by Shulman and so on. So we are beginning, that's what they're doing in Europe, thinking about all of those sorts of things. And Grey, like many people, was interested in that. So he had this little bit of an ethnological approach to life, and so he was interested in Aboriginal people.
Is that mirrored, though, in the colonial experience, and how does it come through the artwork?
Well, it comes through Gray's artwork because he's the first person to see Aboriginal art, and he actually records it and says, this is amazingly complicated, sophisticated stuff. He did have one slight lapse. He thought, these fellas we can see around here, I don't think they could have done it. But nevertheless, he did record it, and he did say it's extremely powerful and very interesting. But in his walk down, he did another interesting thing, is that he, like a lot of the explorers would have done, they saw Aboriginal family groups camping, and they joined the groups. That's where they tended to camp. Mm. And one of these camps, an absolutely amazing thing happened, and it's so brilliant that Grey wrote this down. He approached a camp, and a woman, an elderly woman, ran out to greet him and wailed and wept and so on, and said, "Hello, my son," and embraced him. And then a young woman came up and said, "Hello, my brother," and wept and embraced him. And he had learnt just enough language to understand what they were saying, because that was another thing, of course, about the ethnological thing, learn the language. And he was being recognised as a returned spirit, because, of course, basically, Wodgilas, us whiteys, are pale, and the Noongar understanding of that was that pale-skinned were what were ghosts, were turning. People went off across to the west over the horizon on the Indian Ocean. Well, guess where these people, these pale-skinned people came? They came back from that west over the Indian Ocean.
And they materialise it almost
out of
nothing.
Here we are, here's my son. But I think this is one of the greatest testament to the young George Grey. He took it in good part. He didn't mock it. He said, my own mother would have behaved pretty much like this if this had happened. And then an older man came up and stood in the formal way that they did, which was with their chest to chest, and grasped him and said, my son. And he was accepted into that family. And he writes about it in a way that's not mocking, not ridiculing it, but understanding it. And it's after that in the book, a little while after that, that he says, these people have got an understanding of ownership of the land that is quite as complicated and detailed and intricate as any white land owning ideas.
And it's still taking Australians a long time in many quarters to come to understand that. In the book, do you then contrast that experience of Grey with what art history shows us?
Art history shows us that, first of all, that the English came from a country where the verbal language was English, the visual language was landscape painting. And landscape painting was a very big thing. Just think of England, think of Georgiana Molloy, what she came from. She was hearing the the enlightened speakers, she was looking at Constable and Turner and all of that huge school of English landscape painters that overtook the country. Everyone, it's really interesting little spot in history, because it's also the invention of watercolour paintings and the Watercolour Society, and thousands of people realised they could learn to paint cheaply and easily. Little box of paints, a bit of water and a bit of paper, that's all you need. And it liberated many, many people in Europe to learn to paint. Of course, that liberated the people on the ships, the sailors, to be able to record all of their things so quickly and easily. But it's landscape painting is a language. And when you think of Constable, just think of some of the famous paintings, they are actually like a definition of Britishness. And they are have that great sentimental and patriotic status in people's hearts. That language is the language that they bring here, and they start painting landscapes. So in this whole book, there are almost, there's hardly a single thing that isn't a landscape. There's not one single portrait painted in this book that was painted in WA. There's no interiors, there's no nothing else. It is entirely landscape painting. And that's, so first of all, it's this sentimental, patriotic Britishness. So paint a picture of where you are, and you'll feel that you've got a head around it, you'll feel at home, you can relax, you're British. Here it is.
You say it's really, they're all British landscapes. It's yes. John Constable, perhaps Hans Heysen.
That's right.
Could be put into the same category.
Of course, it goes on in Australian art to that whole landscape tradition, but that's the era that we're in of landscape painting.
When you set out and had the idea for the book, what were you wanting to achieve? What were you wanting to convey to the reader and the viewer of the plates? And did it change when you came to conclude it?
I guess the first thing I wanted to show, really, is that here are the things of our history, and they are there's quite a broad range of things. Some of them are the famous, beautiful plant illustrations done on the Bodin and Matthew Flinders expedition, both of whom had the greatest artists of the time making those things. That's our history. It's ours. We should claim it. It's very classy, European, but it's ours as well. But secondly, when you get here and look at the things that were done here, these pictures are as valuable as anyone else's pictures. You can analyse them in the same way. You can apply all the rules that you want to apply. For instance, and I mainly talk about Romanticism, and the style we would call what most of these are done in is the picturesque. In other words, making a nice view. And you can see how that matches with watercolour painting. That's what everyone's entertainment was. Making a nice view. How do you make that nice view? Picturesque painting. But then if you want to go to the grander scale of Romanticism, you're talking about the Turners and, the, for instance, in music, Beethoven and other painters. You know, it's serious stuff, Romanticism. It's Goya, it's Delacroix. So the very powerful painting of political meaning and so on. So we can apply all of those same ideas to these things that are our history. So I've tried to look at our stuff in terms of that vocabulary that we would apply to anything from that era.
And if one can sum up the conclusions you reach, what are they?
The conclusions are that we can tell a lot of stories by looking at these pictures. I put it together so it's like a model. Anyone could follow this model and do it with their own stuff. If you could do it with a small, a country town could do it, or Queensland could do it, or you know, somewhere could do it. By putting a body of material together and immersing yourself in it, seeing what you learn from it, looking at the painting, just enjoying the painting, reading some of the stuff that goes with it. Like, for instance, George Gray was such an interesting thing for me. But just knowing the details of the people, and it's sort of an immersive experience, and you learn things from it, and you learn that there is a story to be seen from it, and you can understand that colonial idea of wanting to take the land. Here it is. We can see it in this landscape. We can see the opportunity. We're going to take it. But the book ends with a convict artist who actually came from busy London jewellers and so on. I mean, if he hadn't gone off the rails, he would have been working for William Morris and making wallpaper or something like that in London, and would have been a prosperous fellow. Somehow or other, he got caught up in with some crooks and ended up on a ship to Australia. He was clever, he was literate, but he somehow or other had something in him that didn't make him ever successful. He also had TB. He ends up by painting some pictures where you can see that he's actually sitting with some Aboriginal people, with the Noongars around Perth. We can identify who paints the river across to South Perth. He's sitting on the ground. In other words, the perspective of the painting tells us everything we need to know. He's living with them. He's on the ground with them. And he shows us all the details of their life.
They're just phenomenal, aren't they?
But we know from what was on his cell in Fremantle that he's a classical painter. I like to think of him as being, having learnt that. I mean, he didn't go to art school. He was a poor boy that worked in a jewellery shop.
His name was James Walsh.
James Walsh. But he came here and he uses these skills. They're not like classical painting, but they're very skilled paintings. And he's obviously on the ground with the Noongars, and he paints an absolutely brilliant series of daily life with them. And some of them are such telling pictures. There's one that's the looking across the river on the Perth foreshore, looking across to South Perth.
There's the old mill.
The old mill over there, you can see exactly where it is. And these figures, these boys are fishing, and they're like monumental figures. They're like, think of Goya and the monster on the hill, the Gorgon, consuming the figures. Of the little people. It's really it's a romantic picture of that sort of scale. It's like let your mind see it as a Goya.
He's painting, I think, in the late 1850s, 1860s.
That's right. And these monumental figures, the boys completely dominating the scene, just inhabiting it.
An absolutely beautiful painting that a lot more people need to be familiar with.
That's right. But they're only little things, actually. They're postcard-sized things. But the contents of that painting is like a great, important painting. He also then does another one. He does lots of daily life, but he does another one of the...
Receiving... Which one are you looking
receiving
at?
Receiving
spirits.
Receiving the spirits.
Yes.
And it's three Aboriginal men. One... is passing a bottle of wine or some grog of some sort,
yes,
to another, and the third one is behind observing the scene. Once again, they're figures, monumental figures against a landscape, like the huge figures. But this picture to me always looks like the missionary holding up the cross, sign up to Christianity sort of thing. In one way, but another way, you can see the eager hand taking the grog. The man behind is watching and saying, "This can't be good." It's like Walsh actually writing an essay about the dangers he can see of alcohol in the community. What this incredible destruction that's going to come from grog, and of course, it's done he's a Christian of some sort. He was certainly brought up Catholic. He was probably Irish. But he then signs up later as Church of England, which is probably more practical in the colony. But he is completely literate in the theology of look after the poor, don't do, you know, kindness. And he's telling that whole story of the dangers of alcohol.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because the person, the man in the middle, is also puffing on a pipe, it appears.
Well, they had their own,
yes,
pipes and smoking and so on, but they also had European... Walsh doesn't tell us what
no.
he's smoking. But the grog, the passing of the grog...
Is a very significant
painting. And then the book ends, actually, with another Walsh painting, which is the complete... counterpoint to what are the main paintings. So the traditional painting of Perth was done from Mount Eliza. It looked down on the city. The very first one is done before there was a city in 1827 by Garling. Shows us the land we're going to take. He paints this beautiful landscape of the Virgin Swan River. And then from then on, that becomes the iconic picture of here is our colony. It looks real to me. I think watercolour painting is giving us the big tick, we're here to stay. But Walsh completely turns that around and puts two Aboriginal people looking down on the top, and it's a very sad painting. It's the moment when of their recognition of catastrophic loss.
It's called Scene Near the River, in parenthesis Black Boy, and it was painted in 1860. It's actually a beautiful painting. It's, in that sense, the best of pencil and watercolour that you could ask for, the reflections in the river.
That's right.
The ethnographic interest in the clothing that's being worn,
yep.
The whole thing.
Yep.
Philippa, congratulations on producing this book. I said at the outset, when people look at it, they might think it's a coffee table book. It is such a book. The plates in it, you just want to stop and hear you talk about as you have been. The text, I can assure our listeners, is instructive. Historically, ethnographically, it provides the context that you've been describing today, in which you can place these paintings and these works of art. There are photographs. We've got Aboriginal artwork in here as well, the traditional work, some of which Gray might have seen, but some of it he wouldn't have. It's a book that's been published by the Alan Brook Cultural Foundation. How did that come about?
In a strange way. It truly does grow from my experience of being part of the design team of Alan Brook, which has been for the last 30 years unrecognised by most people in Perth as an important thing. It had a very superior, excellent group of people working on that project, which is, of course, a big semi-government, 50-50 joint venture with the state government project. And Alan Brook has been the laboratory for many things for the state government.
Just remind our listeners, many of them who are West Australian or live around Guildford and Midland know exactly where Alan Brook is, but where is it, and why is that area of some cultural interest?
Well, it's of great interest to this book because it's actually the starting point for it all. Alan Brook basically borders onto Nangara Road, and at the very end of Nangara Road, it actually doesn't quite go. You have to go 100 yards off. Keep going on Nangara Road for another 100 yards instead of turning off onto East or West Swan Road. And you will come to a little old church, the oldest church in the state, still existing. And that church is built on the land where Stirling and his 17 others, soldiers and a couple of other people like Garling the artist, camped in 1827. And they had sailed up the river on their expedition, to Stirling's expedition, to get the evidence he needed to support his claim to have start a colony. And they camped at Alan Brook. Sailing up the river, Garling had been sent to do pictures that showed us really what the country was like, because Governor Darling in Sydney did not actually trust Stirling, who always put a very shiny gloss on everything. And he sent Garling along to tell the truth. But in fact, Garling did very beautiful pictures that helped the argument and helped contributed to this disappointment that the settlers later felt when it didn't live up to the pictures. But in fact, Garling's pictures are a true representation of how the river looked, how beautiful it was, but also of Aboriginal farming, because it shows you the fields of grain on both sides of the river. It shows you this beautifully maintained river all the way up there. And so that at the little church in very close to Alan Brook is that spot where they camped. And Garling walked up the hill to straight up the hill. You can imagine exactly where he went, just above you, where you sit now, and you can look down and see the railway coming through Avon Valley Park. And
the earliest settlers, when Stirling came back in 1829 into 1830, claimed that same area very quickly for their farms, didn't they?
Well, it was the Swan Valley was the elite farms. So all the people with the first claims on anything wanted Swan Valley land. And in fact, in no time at all, the land was taken. And some of it then got split up a bit more with subdivisions of people that were absentee landlords and things. But one thing about the Swan Valley land that is very interesting is that they were all what they called ribbon grants. So that was, they had one chain, 22 feet, metres, something or other, and it was a long, thin land grant. It might have been 5 km long, right up to the hills, because everyone wanted that strip of river.
They wanted a bit of water.
They wanted the water. Water, river was everything.
And the Allenbrook project that you were engaged in has to do with the planning of a community.
It was a really interesting job for all of us to do, to make a new town. It's extremely well planned. It's, to me, one of the attractive things was it about that it's not an elite development. It's got state housing in there, and it's the fruits of it are will in the future be a very beautiful place, I think. It's very well planned to have the services. It's in fact an amazing hub of education. I think there's something like 17 schools within the immediate area, 5 high schools, and it's absolutely will in the future be a very interesting place.
A student of Allenbrook, who then picked up your book, No Stone Without a Name, and started reading it, would quickly enough, I think, appreciate that it does have its origins in that area, but it blossoms and extends way beyond it. What caught your fancy? What happened in the course of your involvement in the Allenbrook planning? And did you start looking at documents that piqued your interest? Did you start painting it yourself? What happened?
My job in the design team, and it's the only job that I know of existing for this particular purpose, I was employed as an artist. In that case, I had to make a few things. Like, the very first job was to make an entry for it.
Wow.
I know. This is what all the commercial things do, though. What's known in the business as an entry statement. Well, you see them all over the place, and they look like some sort of almost advertising, or some of them are just straightforward advertising with some embellishment that might have come from an artist. This was not something that I was even remotely interested in doing. So my first one, which was my first take, is to do with the fact that Allenbrook was actually the sand pit that provided building sand for the metropolitan area at that stage. But the reason the development went ahead is that they got down to water level and they couldn't use, had its day. And it was amazing because all over this barren place that had been bulldozed flat and clean, but a little time elapses, and all over it was these amazing young Banksias with the energy that's just hard to imagine how vigorous they were. And all sorts of other young trees sprouting up all over the place. And so my original responses were all about the re-greening, the bringing back to life again of the place. But as I went on, I realised that I needed to make people feel some sort of sense of identity for the place, because it's these new developments are faceless, ghastly, endless, new awfulness. And so to try and bring some ideas to it and some sense of identity, but also some sense of pride and ownership of the people, something to hang on to, something that they can grasp. And so I started to think about the history, because of course the name Allenbrook is 2 years older than Perth. It's
Governor Stirling's wife.
That's right. He's Stirling, and the boys are sitting there in their little camp on these beautiful March evenings. They write about how beautiful it was, how they had an oversupply of everything, including cheerfulness, he writes. And they were having a very nice time, and they're sitting by the campsite, and Stirling names the little stream that he sees there, Ellensbrook, after his wife. And so it has got a real connection with those very early days of the settlement. So I just wanted to give people a sense of that, of it having some history, first of all, because this thing about Australia not having history. You know, when I went to school, nobody wanted to do Australian history because it was so boring. It was a boy's story about exploration. It had no sense of any sort of ordinary society. It was some artificial thing of blokes stomping around with guns in the bush. It was just not an attractive thing. Or after that, very dry legal things about land ownership. It had no sense of social history at all. So it was to try and bring some life into that feeling of history. But it was a bit of an uphill battle, because as soon as I started, I realised that nobody, not only nobody at Ellenbrook, nobody in the team, virtually nobody knows any of this sort of history, West Australian history.
So you've pored through the art history, but you've also, I imagine, pored through other historical documents, and you've had to inform yourself about the times.
That's very true. I guess my education, I've got an English degree from the University of Western Australia, which means I sort of a bit of a full bottle on the 19th century. But on the other hand, when I did history at UWA, there were two choices. You could do European Elizabethan history, or you could do English Elizabethan history. Australian history was not something that people did. But of course, things have really changed now. But doing the history is actually, I think, we're sort of in the maturing stage of Australian history, because, first of all, it's been the colonial story. Well, the colonial story about pioneers and all of that, it's a bit like that dry land history that we had before. Pioneers are almost all male. There's a very famous first history of WA written by a man called Kimberley, who came here in 1899. It was published, and it's in two parts. First of all, Kimberley was a journalist, and he was given a grant by the state government to write a history, and he did do a good job of that history, pretty good. The two-thirds of the book, though, are individual entries by our noted citizens. Well, I can tell you that our noted citizens are entirely male. There is not a single woman in our leading citizens. And our leading citizens are pompous men who are probably not that cool by the best standards you could judge them, but who write up their own histories with a lot of admiration for themselves. And they also say, everyone's got this sort of subtext of having to say something about the fact that they're here, and they know that there were other people here before. So they mainly say things like, Mr. J... had good relationships with the Aborigines because of his firm approach, which they understood and respected. That means he shot them if he didn't like them. And everyone understood the statement, everyone understood the subtext. And so we've sort of got to this point now where we have to take a more complex look at it. So we can't accept that all the settlers were male. We can't accept that they were all great fellows, like they would like to tell you. We now have to see that it's a battle, or it's a world where two lots of people were fighting for their rights.
I'm sitting here thinking about, yes, the history I was taught might have been a lot different from yours, I suspect. It was frozen for a long period, but, and even more peculiar, growing up, born in Pinjarra, travelled a fair amount of country, Western Australia, with my parents, being well-schooled, but history was Blaxland, Lawson and Wentworth,
who
crossed the Blue Mountains, for goodness sake.
Blokes
on the other side of the country.
That's right, absolutely.
There were bits and pieces, but you're right. Indigenous people hardly figured in the story.
Well, they were a problem you sometimes had to say something about, but mainly, or perhaps you took one with you for instance, there's lots of stories, like, for instance, one of the northern expeditions, Philip Parker King.
Oh, yes.
Philip Parker King has with him someone, or even I think Matthew Flinders also had an Aboriginal person with them,
probably
which they thought would solve all the problems.
From Port Jackson or something.
He came from Sydney, yes. So in other words, he didn't speak the language in Northern Australia. But not only that, he had to explain his presence to the locals in the same way.
He was equally a foreigner.
Yes, that's right.
It is amazing, isn't it? And you're right. I mean, Forrest writes his journals up, John, and they're quite interesting to read. And he has a couple of black trackers with him. Mm. And it's lovely, at least today, when you drive south from Fremantle on the Kwinana Freeway, the forest freeway, you cross Windich Bridge.
That's right.
One of those trackers was Tommy Windich,
that's
who
right.
has his own yes. family descendants today. At least things are changing. And your book, may I say, is going to instruct and excite a whole lot of people. Did you ever, do you have, having produced it and now it's out there, a desired reader in mind? Is this for everybody? I think it is.
I have tried to make it for everybody. I really have. I had a couple of principles in putting the book together. The first one was that the words and the picture are always going to be on the same page. And it's written in plain language, but I'm a great believer that if you can't say a complicated idea in plain language, you better go and think about it a bit more, because anything can be said plainly, and I have tried at all times to write plain English. It's quite opinionated. No one was paying me to do anything that I didn't want to do, so you've got strictly my thinking on the subject, which is sometimes giving you a bit of a double take about official histories. I've also tried to put it in the context of other history you might know, like, for instance, the Florence Nightingale example. I've tried to show you it's always linked in with world history. But I mean, for instance, there's a little example when talking about some pictures of Fremantle. I've tried to give each one a different subtext. And one of them, for instance, there's no picture of this, so I couldn't put a picture in, but it was just I wanted to mention slavery. And in fact, some settlers who came to the Swan Valley, the De Bruins had bought a ship, and it actually was one of the most awful slave ships. They bought the ship after it had been, of course, the British had...
1833.
1833 voted against slavery, and it was therefore ships could be... arrested if they were slavers, and this ship was taken by British forces, and the De Bruins bought it cheaply and sailed themselves to WA. It would have covered in its days as a slaver, it would have had something like 400 people squeezed onto it. I think it's something like 11 of them sailed here, and
Yes. So much to be learned.
But it's just, I mean, there's all of those things, all of these great world things that are going on are all reflected here in some way.
Philippa O'Brien, thank you for meeting with me and talking about it. I'm sure people are going to love reading this book. Congratulations.
I hope so.